Subcommittee on Public Safety.
We were busy solving a problem over there.
Today is March 18th, 2015. We're here for a public hearing on the Department of Corrections Budget Bill, Senate Bill 5504. Linda, would you like to tee anything up for us?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Posted under yesterday's date, March 17th, on OLS are responses to questions that arose yesterday having to do with release planning, firefighting, and behavioral health services beds. And we are starting today on slide number 89. And Ms. Stewart is eager to keep going.
Yes, I am.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Shields, Co-Chair Williamson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Heidi Stewart. I'm the Assistant Director of the Offender Management and Rehabilitation Division with the Oregon Department of Corrections. And we are picking right back up where we left off yesterday with education measures. Education is one of our core measurements on the agency scorecard. Using 2012 intake population, 37% of offenders coming into our custody did not have a GED. On average, 56% of releasing inmates who needed a GED had earned a GED at their time of release. On January 1st, 2014, the delivery format and complexity of the GED test changed and is now 100% computer-based and is a much more rigorous test than before. The department had the GED computer-based testing lab sites up and available at 12 institutions by January 1st, 2014. However, due to delays in contractual agreements with the GED testing vendor, we did not start actually administering tests until August of 2014. The Volunteer Services Program is a centralized unit responsible for managing volunteers, assisting with volunteer recruitment, training volunteers, and performing background checks on our volunteers. The Volunteer Services Program includes over 2,400 active volunteers who donate their time and skills to provide essential services and activities to our population. The importance of volunteers providing programs within our institutions cannot be stressed strongly enough. Without their valuable support, there would be many programs and services that our men and women would go without. We know that treatment and behavioral change programming is another area that contributes to lowering recidivism, and we have prioritized treatment programs for those with a high need and coupled with medium to high risk to reoffend. All of our treatment programs incorporate evidence-based practices for cognitive behavioral models of intervention and focus on drug-free community living and pro-social thinking. The department offers 8 treatment programs. 6 of these treatment programs are alcohol and drug programs. 2 are cognitive-based programs with an A&D component. Unfortunately, there's always a gap between the resources that we do have and the number of individuals who need our services. Our behavioral change programs include cognitive restructuring and parenting. Cognitive restructuring programs are skill-building programs that help inmates identify what led to their criminal behavior by examining their attitudes, their beliefs, their thinking patterns, and their values. And the goal of these programs are to teach pro-social skills that will lead to successful reentry back into the community. Parenting programs teach parenting management skills. They help parents acquire skills that improve their parent-child interaction, enhance family relationships, replace antisocial parenting skills with pro-social skills that promote healthy child adjustment and provide problem behaviors and prevent problem behaviors with their children and hopefully interrupt the intergenerational cycle of criminality. I'm going to briefly go over a few of our scorecard measures relating to treatment and programming. Again, treatment programs are targeted to inmates who have a treatment need and who are high to moderate risk of reoffending. This measure shows the percentage of releasing medium and high-risk inmates successfully completing treatment during the past 5 fiscal years. Between 2012 and 2013, we saw a high level of low-risk inmates being treated within our programs, which accounts for the decline in those years. We have since remedied the situation, and as you can see, we're trending back upward and sending our moderate to high-risk inmates into those programs. This measure shows the percentage of releasing inmates during each fiscal year that successfully completed a cognitive behavioral change program. Over the past several biennia, the cognitive behavioral change programs... Change programs have increased in intensity and duration in order to align with evidence-based practices and enhance accountability to behavioral expectations and curriculum standards. In 2012, we had two cognitive behavioral programs that we merged into one single program. This was to increase quality of the program, and when we did that, the level of difficulty increased as well. And as you can see, because of the difficulty of the programs, we had a slight decrease in those who completed the program successfully. A five-year research study from 2003 to 2008, funded by the National Institute of Mental Health and conducted by the Oregon Social Learning Center, interviewed and followed Oregon inmates who were actively parenting upon release. The study found that women were 59% and men were 27% less likely to be rearrested 1 year after their release from prison than those in a control group. The department has a small allocation of general fund dollars to support the offering of Parenting Inside Out. This measure shows the percentage that successfully completed the parenting program. It was previously reported that a 2009 study indicated Parenting Inside Out was not effective in reducing recidivism. A longitudinal study was being conducted at the time. But in an effort to respond to questions coming from budget reduction conversations for non-mandated programs, data was pulled too early from the preliminary information gathered for the study. It was later determined that not all Parenting Inside Out participants had been interviewed, and the results were excluded from the preliminary data. The follow-up data collection and the longitudinal study determined that Parenting Inside Out is, in fact, effective in reducing recidivism.
Heidi, can I ask you a question about that?
Absolutely.
So these were two different studies, correct?
Correct.
And so one was done by DOC, Paul Blatty, found no effect on recidivism of Parenting Inside Out. Then a second study did. Is that right?
That's my understanding. Correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
So I believe this is a program I've heard about. So how many people are involved and what's the cost?
I do not have the numbers in front of me as far as how many have participated in the program, but I can get that to you by tomorrow.
Are there 100 people or are there 20 people? Do you have any idea at all?
I do not. For the record, this is Colette Peters, Director of the Department of Corrections. Good afternoon. I do not know. I think the program that you may be referring to is the Family Preservation Program. I think there's been lots of conversation around that program. And that program was serving 11 women and I believe 21 children.
That's part of the one I'm
That's the one you're thinking of. The Parenting Inside or the Parenting Inside Out program is a parenting curriculum that we're able to give to, I would say, hundreds of adults in custody, both men and women alike.
Great. Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. Can I ask you a question about that? Could you describe Parenting Inside Out? What is it? How long does it last? How often is it didactic or is it therapeutic?
Parenting programs serve an average of 16 inmates over the course of 12 weeks. It involves development in communication, problem solving, emotional regulation, stress management, and anger management.
So is it a classroom setting?
It is a classroom setting, Chair.
Thank you.
Yes.
And one last thing. Do you know if that study from 2009 that DOC did that said that there was no effect on recidivism, do you know if that's being considered in the Oregon Social Learning Center's study as part of a literature review? Is that part of their record?
Co-chairs, I do not know if it is or not. We can check and verify that. I do know that the difference between the Paul Velati study and the Oregon Social Learning Center study was that Paul Velati's study didn't include if the individual was going to parent on the outside, and the Oregon Social Learning Center study did include that if you are going to parent on the outside, then the PIO program was successful. Paul's study looked at, we didn't necessarily screen, if you were a parent and you qualified for the parenting program, you got into the parenting class. And so the connectivity really was between that family engagement and that family connectivity coupled with learning how to better parent while you're inside prison.
So you're saying in the Oregon Social, well, the Mark Eddy study, he removed the people from the kind of the N if they weren't going to be parenting on the outside, even though they received the intervention?
Co-Chair Shields, no. He didn't necessarily remove them from the data point. He concluded that parenting inside out is evidence-based if you receive the program and you parent on the outside. If you're not parenting on the outside, they did not find a reduction of recidivism with that program.
Oh, even in the other one?
That is correct.
Okay.
Chair.
Yes.
Could we have a copy of that report?
Yeah, that would be helpful. And also, if you could scour your files to see if the 2009 study from Paul Bilotti would be available, that would be good, too.
And a follow-up question.
Follow-up.
The report may have this in it. Was parenting on the outside in and of itself something to help reduce recidivism versus parenting on the outside plus the program? I mean, I would think that people came out taking care of kids are a little less likely to come back in simply because they have a connection there.
Co-chairs and Senator Bates, I don't believe that the Oregon Social Learning Center study did. However, Ms. Stewart mentioned a study earlier that came out of the Minnesota Department of Corrections that said maintaining that connectivity with families made a big difference in the reduction of recidivism. In fact, they said it was the single most overriding factor in the reduction. And while there was some statistical significance in who visited, if it was a father or mother, that could significantly increase the positive impact of that. If it was their divorced spouse, it actually negatively impacted the results. So I know that just that family connectivity is so important. And so that's why we have really worked hard to expand our visiting and family engagement model at the Department of Corrections. The Parenting Inside Out program that we were referring to also is now on the national database of evidence-based programs. So it now is on that national registry as well.
Please proceed.
Thank you. The Office of Inmate and Community Advocacy monitors quality of life standards and ensures voices of the adults in our custody, their friends, and families are heard. In doing so, we create positive environments conducive for inmate management while supporting and encouraging family connections. The office coordinates and provides policy direction on statewide systems that deliver constitutionally mandated services, including institution mailrooms, institution legal libraries, and the inmate grievance system. Additionally, this office is in the process of developing a mentor program to enhance our recidivism reduction strategies. Religious services provides a wide continuum of faith-based services to meet constitutional and legal mandates, as well as advises the institutions on issues related to the compliance with the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act, also known as RLUPA. Through a combination of department chaplains and numerous volunteers, religious services provides group and individual spiritual services, rehabilitative programs and activities, and pastoral counseling to those in special housing. The Religious Services Unit also facilitates the Home for Good in Oregon program, which is a faith-based reentry effort that provides pre- and post-release transitional support. Also under the umbrella of Religious Services is the Crime Victim Services Unit. This unit coordinates the VINE system, which we talked about yesterday. VINE is a free and anonymous service designed to provide crime victims information and notification about offenders' current custody status. Additionally, Crime Victim Services encompasses restorative justice, which is a philosophical framework and series of criminal justice programs that emphasize the need to repair the harm done to victims and the community. Transition and reentry. This unit coordinates release planning efforts for all inmates releasing from the Department of Corrections. It processes visiting applications so family members, friends, and other support persons can stay connected during their time of incarceration. Processes inmate applications for birth certificates and replacement Social Security cards, and helps inmates apply for federal and state benefits at release. Release planning includes developing a release plan for each inmate, which encompasses supervision requirements, housing and employment options, support services, medical and mental health care referrals, includes applying for Medicaid under the Affordable Health Care Act and Social Security benefits. Documentation necessary for gaining employment and access to services is also included. And I believe in the packets that you...
Representative Williamson.
Heidi, I just wanted to know if we ever solved the problem, excuse me, of people getting driver's licenses or ID cards before they're released.
Co-chair, that is an issue that we are continually working on. We've been working very closely with the Department of Motor Vehicles. We do. We have two programs in place. I talked about it a little bit yesterday. Yeah. We can get you more detailed information if you would like. The valid with previous photo process, uh-huh. and also the DMV trip set where we actually... individuals that don't have a photo on file with the DMV will take them to the DMV office if we were able to gather the proper documentation where they can get their picture taken and get an ID prior to release. We have a work group working right now on streamlining the processes, and we expect those numbers to go up, which is why I said we have a budget driver that is going to increase the cost.
Okay.
Mr. Chair. Representative Wisniewski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mrs. Stromberg. That brings up an interesting question. Felons that complete their sentence are still not eligible to vote. Is that correct?
That co-chairs, Representative Wisniewski, I believe that's incorrect. They can actually register to vote as soon as they're outside of our custody.
Correct.
Mm-hmm.
Correct. That ends my question.
Okay. I believe that in the information we provided to you earlier today, there should be more detailed information about the release planning process in there. So if you have additional questions after that, please let me know. This unit also provides skills-based transition programming designed to address common barriers to reentry, primarily through the department's Road to Success transition curriculum. The unit staffs the Governor's Reentry Council, which is chaired by Director Peters. The Reentry Council is a partnership among multiple state, federal, and local agencies and community organizations to improve inmate success with their transition from incarceration out into the community. We also have an Employment Skills Reentry Breakthrough Initiative, which is focused on improving systems to better prepare individuals for employment opportunities after they release. The Offender Management and Rehabilitation Division has improved programs and provided cost savings in a number of areas. Increasing the number of those releasing with birth certificates and Social Security cards assists offenders with obtaining state identification and housing, thus creating more stability and potentially lowering recidivism rate. We created a process for youthful offenders to bypass the intake center with the Department of Corrections and admit directly to the Oregon Youth Authority. This should reduce transport costs in addition to bringing us in compliance with PREA standards. We implemented the Affordable Care Act, expanding access to Medicaid for persons between the ages of 19 and 64, releasing from incarceration. By enrolling those individuals who are eligible for Medicaid benefits that become effective upon release, these increases releasing offenders' access to continuing care services. The department has been working with the Federal Veterans Administration to improve access to VA services and resources for releasing individuals. And that concludes my portion of the presentation, and I'm happy to answer any additional questions.
I have no question, but as you actually go through your processes and identify, it would be helpful because we often hear about all the nice things that are going on. And sometimes we don't hear about the barriers, mm-hmm. and I know that you have them.
Absolutely.
And that it would be well to share some of those barriers with this body. The good senator and I have been talking to one of the other agencies about the handoff, mm-hmm. Particularly as they go into the Oregon Health Authority and the CCOs to assure that mental health and alcohol and drug treatment, that there becomes a seamless system. So, you know, that's just one. I would suspect that housing probably is another one.
Absolutely.
And so it's helpful when we, you know, understand what some of those barriers are just to help to facilitate your job, particularly since, you know, our real focus anymore is trying to further, although you're doing a great job in reducing recidivism, we'd like to reduce it even further and stop the revolving door. So.
Co-chair Senator Winters, thank you. We are happy to provide you a list of barriers.
Thank you, Heidi, or Director. So I found the Mark Eddy study you were talking about. Now, do you give the Parenting Inside Out curriculum to people that meet this criteria in the study, that they have parent or children of a certain age, and then they have some role in parenting their children and are expected to in the future? Is everybody getting that same criteria in order to even get the program now?
Mr. Co-Chair, I do not know for certain the answer to that, Ms. Stewart.
We'll have to
looking
get,
at our yeah. notes, but we can confirm that for yep. you. Thank
okay.
you.
So just to review there, if you could find out kind of the eligibility criteria for people, all the people served now in Parenting Inside Out, we'd also like to get that 2009 study compared to the Eddy study, and also see if you can find out if the 2009 study was included in the literature review of the other. Because if that study's out there, even if it's unpublished, it would seem to me that it would need to be part of the literature review. Thanks.
Happy to do that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Bates.
Thank you. I'm probably open a can of worms or shouldn't, but so I'm trying to get a picture of what it's like for the individual coming out. Our goal is to keep them from coming back in again. So they come out. They've got a... assignment for Medicaid, probably don't have an appointment with a physician, probably have an appointment with their PO?
Always has an appointment okay. with their PO. They have to report within 24 hours.
Okay. It may or may not have a place to live. Are being sent back to probably where they committed their crime or lived before, which may or may not be appropriate for them, but it's very hard to change.
Co-Chair Senator Bates, they are sent back to the county they lived in at the time they committed their crime.
Even if that's not where their family is now and not where their connections are now, where, I mean...
I hope I'm not stealing Mr. Stromberg's thunder, but they... There is a process, there's a waiver process that these individuals can apply for. So if their support system is in a different county, they can apply for a waiver, and then they can, if the county approves, go to another county.
Is that a straightforward process, or is it difficult?
It's pretty straightforward, and the counties actually work very well together. That I wouldn't put that on my list of barriers.
Okay.
Yep.
So they can move back and forth as necessary.
Okay.
All
right.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep, you're welcome.
And also
Thank
keep
you.
In mind, inmates are counted in their where they're incarcerated for purposes of redistricting, as opposed to where they came from. Which is
He's always political.
An interesting quirk.
Political?
Is this fact? All right.
I would assume that's a rounding error. Okay.
Co-chairs, those questions are actually a great segue to introduce the next person that I'm bringing forward, Assistant Director Jeremiah Stromberg. Again, I'm so proud to have him as part of the team. He has a full career in public safety. You will also remember him as a former member of the Parole Board and Post-Prison Supervision, and prior to that, he was the Executive Director for the Parole Board. Before joining the Parole Board, he worked for Multnomah County for 12 years, and worked in a variety of programs and units, including domestic violence, sex offender treatment, and drug and alcohol treatment. I will tell you, with all of that, one of the things that I am so grateful for in his role is his credibility and relationships with our public safety partners, our chiefs, our sheriffs, and our DAs. He has been instrumental in helping us manage the justice reinvestment conversation, which I know is near and dear to many of you, and in helping us with those collaborations. He also, in this role, given his background, really is helping the agency evolve to that place that we wanted it to be at, where everything we do beyond accountability is about reentry. And that collaboration with community corrections is something he's really able to bring to the table and push that vision forward. So with that, I will hand it off to Mr. Stromberg.
Thank you, Director. Good afternoon, Co-Chairs Williamson, Co-Chair Shields, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeremiah Stromberg. I am the Assistant Director of the Community Corrections Division within the Oregon Department of Corrections. And the Community Corrections Division is responsible for both direct and indirect supervision and oversight of all parole, post-prison, and probation services. Our direct service is in three main subdivisions, as you'll see on the board. That's our administration oversight, our interstate compact unit, and then direct supervision of Linn and Douglas counties. Within that, we also then indirectly oversee Senate Bill 1145, which governs county authority and their responsibilities for community corrections functions. So within the Department of Corrections, our staff make up only 1.5% of the department personnel, again, as the bulk of the work is done through the 34 counties that are not a part of the Department of Corrections. And in addition, the governor's balanced budget would make up then 16% of the overall budget for the Department of Corrections. And that includes all of the pass-through monies that we allocate out to the counties, which we have a breakdown a little bit later for you as well. And so there are two major budget drivers in determining the community corrections baseline budget. And while I'm not going to go into a lot of detail on this unless you have specific question, let me first tell you that we have to develop a capitated rate. And that is, what is the daily cost of supervision and to manage the community corrections population within the community? And then once we've determined that rate, we apply that to the forecast for the next budget. The next biennium of how many offenders we're going to be supervising. And so we use this funding formula each and every biennium in order to determine what is the baseline funding for community corrections. So within that, this is a chart that breaks down specifically the governor's balanced budget for community corrections. We provide this breakdown to the counties after the release of the governor's balanced budget and then again upon the release of the legislatively adopted budget. And as you can see, there are multiple funding streams from monies designated for very specific populations, such as the sexually violent dangerous offenders, to other general reimbursements, such as those provided under Senate Bill 395 and House Bill 2712. Obviously, the most significant allocation is the Community Corrections Grant and Aid. And I know there's been some questions earlier in the week specifically around opt-out and our funding for community corrections. So again, there's a very consistent formula in determining the capitated rate each biennium that we apply to determine what that baseline funding amount would be. And it's this formula that determines whether or not a county would have the ability to opt out of their responsibility to provide community corrections supervision. The agency request budget, as determined by that formula for the 15-17 biennium, was $243.7 million. And as you can see, should the governor's budget become the legislatively adopted budget without any change to that caseload, the counties would have the ability to opt out of supervision, and the Department of Corrections would assume responsibility for any counties that chose to do so, as Linn and Douglas chose to in 2004. So again, it's not a guarantee that counties automatically would opt out. I've certainly had some informal conversations with counties that would want to further explore whether or not that was the right move for them in their financial situations, but we wouldn't know until that was actually triggered as to whether or not counties would exercise that right.
Excuse me, Representative Gorsuch.
I just want to go, thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to go back to that issue about the counties opting out. How long has it been since the state switched it over so that it was county-based? Do you know how many years that's been?
Co-chairs, Representative Gorsuch, we began this model in the early mid-90s,
okay,
where the DOC no longer was one of the options to provide supervision without an opt-out triggered. Only once during that period of time in 2004, for a brief window, did that funding drop below the level and two counties exercised that option. Statute also allows them to opt back in once per biennium as well. And to date, Linn and Douglas have chosen not to.
Okay. Follow up.
Follow up.
So I'm assuming then that this is Linn and Douglas are being driven by financial concerns at the county level is why they're opting to go with DOC, is that correct?
Co-chairs, Representative Gorsuch, finances play somewhat into it. I mean, the community corrections budget provides a secure set of funding almost regardless of what else is happening within the county. I think within Lynn and Douglas, we have worked very hard to have a very collaborative relationship with their local public safety system. It is working. We would hold our results in those two counties up against the other 34, and I think you would find that we're providing adequate and equal supervision. And for Lynn and Douglas, it has worked well under that model. With changes in leaderships, there's been times when they've raised the question and considered pulling them back. But to date, they've been satisfied with the services they've received from us.
Senator Winters?
Did
you have a follow-up?
Well, one really quick one. So how much could we handle if we had a lot of counties that wanted to opt out? I mean, how much can our budget sustain if, like, you know, 15 counties said, oh, we're going to opt out and do what Lynn and Douglas does?
Sure.
So would we be able to handle that?
Co-chairs Representative Gorsuch, if they were able to opt out, it would mean a couple of things. Number one, the funding for community corrections was lower than what the actual cost is. So we would run into some struggle with providing the same level of service with a reduced budget. Within the department, we could certainly add a small county, two or three, and not have to add to our human resources department, to our budget office, to my staff who help administratively oversee those counties. But if we started talking about the larger counties, then we'd have to look at what that means for our infrastructure to be able to provide adequate supervision and care for our employees in those counties. So it's difficult. It depends on the 15.
Right.
Depends on the region. Could we combine services across county lines and go more with a regional approach? Okay. And so we'd have to explore that depending on the counties.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Winters?
Just a point of clarity. 2004, the discussion was around finances.
Right.
And I think some of us would, because the system as it was built was talking about all 36 and I think some of us would really kind of not want to see us go and change and alter that system and that partnership that we've developed over time. So, you know, hopefully that we're able to manage those resources or get the adequate resources so that the counties will stay engaged and involved.
Co-Chair Senator Winters, if I may, the agency also strongly supports Senate Bill 1145. We, too, would prefer not to see counties opt out, and we certainly prefer the county model and believe that Oregon has a very strong public safety system because of that model, and therefore we certainly encourage that model as well.
Representative Wisnant.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Brokamp, Deputy Director. You made a statement, I just think, just now, that funding is less than cost. So the funding to the counties is less than what it's costing them. Is that true?
Co-chairs, Representative Wisnett, I apologize. My statement was in regards to if counties had the ability to opt out, it would mean funding was below the actual cost, which would allow them to opt out. Currently, in this biennium, the legislature fully funded community corrections, and so they are receiving, based on the actual cost to perform services, the funding they need.
Sir, follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
So what are you funding them at per day, per inmate?
For co-chairs, Representative Wisnett, for this biennium, it is $8 and I believe 62 cents, but we'll follow up on the change. For next biennium, it has been determined the daily cost would be $10.71. It would be the daily cost for supervision on the capitated rate.
Senator Bates.
Looking at the opposite point of view, just for a moment, Josephine and Curry County, if they didn't have this program, knowing that front page news a year ago in Mail Tribune was prisoners are running out of the prison, jumping and screaming, are so happy to get out because of lack of funding. They didn't have to serve their time. It was not people in corrections. It was pretty scary. Some of them went out and within 24 hours committed crimes. If it weren't for this program, where would Curry and Josephine County be? Would they have to close most of their facilities, what little they have left?
So co-chairs, Senator Bates, to answer your question bluntly, yes, they would. The one strength within both of those counties currently is the community corrections funding from the state. They have been able to maintain their parole and probation services in lieu of not having jail space, not having other public safety support systems in place. And so while they can't utilize these monies for some of those other dire needs, it certainly has ensured that supervision remains strong within those two counties.
Just for follow-up statement, we feel like we're sitting next to the hole in the wall, gang. It's 20 minutes from Josephine County to Medford. We have a lot of crime that goes back across the border, and we know where those stolen goods are, what's happening, and nothing happens to those people. It truly is the Wild Wild West, so this program is actually helping stabilize things at least a little bit in Southern Oregon. We appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Krieger and then Representative Wisnett.
We kind of live in the place where the fire's going to, meet the road, so to speak, but I believe they've got funding for the jail till end of June, and maybe a little past that. I haven't got a good public levy, safety levy. I do not think stands much of a chance. The average income is something like 30-some thousand a year. 70% are retired on fixed incomes. So it's a real challenge, and if we start talking about right now, they're already releasing, certain because they've got half the jail closed, so they're releasing a lot of people they wouldn't normally release. Mayor of Gold Beach is upset because they're on the street, and they go over to the all-night places, a couple of them, and stand out front and walk around. Pretty soon they're in trouble, they got them picked up again. Mm-hmm. So we've got some real challenges there, and I don't know where we're going with this in our rural counties, and it's not just Curry County. There's a couple, you talk about Jackson County and Josephine and Klamath, and there's going to be a lot of them in the next couple, 3 or 4 years. Coos County, just a couple years behind. They're drawing down their reserves. I don't think we can expect the rest of the state to pay for our public safety. But at the same time, I don't want to see a catastrophe happen where we have more criminals coming into those areas because they know there's no enforcement. They know there's no jail. And then we're going to have victims. And like I say, a lot of those victims are going to be old people.
Yep. Thank you for that comment. Representative Wisnett, and then we're going to have to jump back into the presentation.
Yeah, real quick, and I didn't understand the numbers 862 and 1071. I'll get that offline. I'm a supporter of the community-based operation. It's all about whether the state gives the counties enough money to run those programs. Even I think a few sessions ago, we talked about extending it from 1 year to 2 year. And I thought that was a good something to look at, or 18 months or something like that, because it's a better place to put them in the community than in the state facilities. So is there any discussion of the going from 1 year to 2 years or something like that?
Co-chairs, Representative Wisnett, and let me clarify, the director has reminded me it was $9.32 for the current biennium, so I was off by about a dollar. And there was some pre-session discussion around the expansion of local control beyond the one-year period to allow for longer sentences to be served locally. I have not seen or heard that has moved forward, and so at this point I don't think there's been further discussion.
Please proceed, and then we've got one more person to present after this. Two. Let's hit the accelerator, and we'll hold questions until the end for the director.
Great. So this slide outlines our priority list as far as the primary areas of focus. Let me share with you in detail a couple of these. First is sort of a little unknown fact. The Department of Corrections is responsible to provide inspections of all lockups, municipal temporary holds, juvenile facilities around the state. So we have two jail inspectors that provide regular and ongoing reviews of all of those facilities. In addition, we work very closely with the Sheriff's Association to ensure timely completion of sheriff-run facilities for inspections while we no longer provide direct inspection for their facilities. Overall, Community Corrections is responsible for more than 32,000 men and women on supervision within the state of Oregon. This is broken down to the local control population that Representative Winsnett and I were just speaking about, as well as those on parole and post-prison supervision, our probation services, and then a category that we on here refer to as leave. This is our short-term transitional leave program and our alternative incarceration programs. So currently, we have approximately 300 inmates in the community being supervised by community corrections. Again, at that $10 a day rate versus something closer to $90 a day, let alone not taking up one of our prison beds. And so this has been a highly successful program, and I'm going to give you some stats later in the presentation about that. We have some very specific concrete measures that we focus on within community corrections. Obviously, and I think Senator Winters, you said it before, we want to see that no one returns to the criminal justice system. And so these are examples of how we hold offenders accountable and provide some consistency and direction across 36 counties. So with our goal to reduce recidivism, obviously we're not satisfied with even one person returning, but we can take pride in a continually reduction in the recidivism rate within the state of Oregon. Some of this great work is being done through the monitoring of conditions. These are the conditions of supervision imposed by the court or the Board of Parole to enhance an offender's likelihood to succeed. Some examples of those include restricting sex offenders from having access to children or requiring offenders to complete drug and alcohol programs. But I need to reiterate that supervision goes well beyond supervising the conditions. It's the development of individualized case plans, recognizing offenders as individuals, focusing on what we call a risk-need-responsivity model. And this creates a culture where we gain buy-in and accountability from the offender. We motivate them to want to make changes in their life. And then we hold them accountable to the plan that we put in place. We've talked a little bit about our supervision of Lynn and Douglas County, so I won't spend much time there. Beyond Lynn and Douglas, though, I spoke about indirect oversight for the other 34 counties. We do hold those counties accountable through their community corrections plan. We have MOUs with them, contracts in place, intergovernmental agreements, and then beyond that, we provide training, education, logistical support to ensure that they are using evidence-based practices, that we are aligning our practices across the state, because certainly with 36 counties, we could do things 36 different ways, and it's important that we adopt the same consistent practices that have been proven to be effective in supervising this population. Next, I want to talk about the Interstate Compact Unit. I want to share a story with you. On November 29th of 2009, former Arkansas inmate and parolee Maurice Clemens murdered four police officers in Parkland, Washington. And this tragic event is an example of how supervision and monitoring of offenders across state lines is so important for the protection of the public. Our Interstate Compact Unit is made up of four staff, and they were responsible this last year for the tracking, monitoring, and communication of almost 3,000 offenders moving into and out of Oregon. Federal mandates and rules have been compiled to provide a consistent approach across states, regardless of our differing supervision styles and values. And the Compact Unit is responsible for overseeing that Oregon's 36 counties and the other 49 states are adhering to the rules of the Compact. So it's important that we continue to support offender movement across state lines. Many times the best opportunity for success resides in another state through housing, family, treatment, support. And many times for those offenders in other states, their best chance for success resides right here in Oregon. And so the Compact Unit is the body that ensures compliance within those rules. So we know who is moving into our state, we're supervising them adequately, and we're aware of who's moving out of state. And with that, I'll also share with you that Oregon has a seat on the National Interstate Commission Executive Board. And I personally am currently chairing the National Compliance Committee to ensure compliance across states for the Interstate Compact. And I'm pleased to report that Oregon will be hosting the Commission's National Conference in fall of 2015 as well. So now a couple of specific measures that I want to share with you. Senator Bates, over the last 2 days, you've talked a lot about those first days of supervision and transition to the community. We focus and look at our success during those first few days. And in this chart, you can see during the first 180 days of release, high levels of successful compliance. This speaks to the reach-ins, the smooth transition that we've developed with our institutions, allowing parole officers into our institutions, our institutional counselors providing clear release plans and support, immediately engaging our offenders into the appropriate treatment programs and services that they need, adequate risk assessment and needs assessments being completed, so we really know what does this person need and where are we going to focus our energy and our monies. Probably the biggest piece you need to take away from this is that only 5% of our inmates leave with an actual job in hand. 5%. And then as we go forward, you can see on this chart, by the time they end supervision, we've increased that to 50% that end up being employed. That's a great improvement, and yet it's still 10 times greater than the unemployment rate for the state as a whole. And so obviously treatment, engagement, and employment are two critical outcomes for our offenders to succeed. Excuse me. The treatment engagement numbers are encouraging, around 30%, keeping in mind that at any given time we have offenders who don't need treatment. We have those that have already completed it, and we have some that just aren't ready for treatment yet. And so this really captures that at any time, a third of ours are engaged in some level of programming within the community. And as you can see, those numbers have remained fairly constant over the last 4 years. And last, well, second to last, I want to focus on restitution and community service. Because obviously supporting our victims and holding offenders accountable to the damage that they have caused is an important and primary focus of supervision. Tracking the restitution paid and the amount of community service completed are two ways in which we monitor that success. In regards to restitution, this measure shows the average amount of restitution paid by the time supervision has ended for the reporting year. This is one of the reasons officers work hard to get their offenders working and why it's so critical that the business community be a part of our reentry and supervision process. In community service as well, this is the amount completed by the end of their supervision period. This is one of those areas, Senator Winters, we absolutely want to see improvements, and we've seen some barriers, as this should be closer to 100% having completed their duties to the court in regards to community service. So it's an area we're continuing to work with the counties on better ways to improve the community service process. And lastly, this graph speaks to those that successfully complete supervision. I want to point out that while it says that 60% of those who serve a period of supervision successfully complete their obligations to the court or the Board of Parole, that doesn't mean the other 40% failed or that they recidivated. Some of them are administratively closed or may have died during supervision. Many others failed to meet a particular condition, but they did not recidivate and they are continuing to do well in the community, but they don't get credit as a successful closure if they did not meet all of those requirements. Again, we want to see this improve and increase. And so some of this is data entry issues that we're working on with the county, certainly with our antiquated data entry and supervision system. And in other areas, it's a matter of our officers ensuring that all of the conditions have been complied with. And then lastly, as I said, I certainly wanted to brag about the short-term transitional leave program. As you know, prior to House Bill 3194, it was an inmate-driven 30-day early release program, and it is now a department-driven 90-day early release program. Through the Justice Reinvestment Funds, counties are able to expend supports and services for this population of offenders in ways that they previously couldn't do. For example, many of the counties have expanded housing services, allowing more offenders to leave our institutions with a guaranteed safe place to reside, even if only temporarily until something more permanent comes along. Transitional leave is also a mechanism for our department to incentivize positive inmate behavior. ensuring that they complete treatment and that we can more smoothly transition them to the community. And it's through our collaboration with the sheriffs, with community corrections directors, and with the Association of Counties that we've been able to tout these successes within this program. As you can see from this chart, this last year we released 1,300 inmates early, and only 4% of them, 60, were returned to the Department of Corrections. And of that 4%, only 1% committed a new crime and were returned to our prisons. The other 3% were returned for technical reasons, ongoing noncompliance. They certainly weren't abiding by the conditions of the TransLeaf program, but they were not committing new crimes. So we've had more than 1,300 inmates in our community this last year through 3194, and it has been highly successful, and it has alleviated the pressure on our prison bed usage as well. And lastly, I just want to share with you two areas that we are focused on this next biennium. The first is, and as I've spoken about, is our continued focus on restitution collection. We've implemented a new strategy in Lynn and Douglas County, and we've seen a fourfold increase in our restitution collection, and we want to be able to roll that out to the rest of the counties to see that more monies are coming in to make victims whole. And second, Oregon is unique in our structured sanctions capability. For an officer to be able to immediately address a negative behavior in the moment without returning to court if an offender waives their right to a hearing. In the late 80s, Oregon's sanctioning grid was the national model, and we haven't updated it since then. And so this year we've embarked on a strategy with the counties to improve our structured sanctioning grid, really align it with our current resources and with the research-based knowledge that we have today about what works in addressing negative behavior. And just as exciting, we're also rolling out a positive incentive grid for officers to know, how do I appropriately and adequately address positive behaviors that I'm seeing so that I can continue to reinforce those positive behaviors, which is what we all want to see on supervision. And with that, I'm happy to answer any other questions you may have.
Representative Barker.
Thank you very much for the presentation. When you talked about people coming out and being unemployed, there's a bill coming through, and I don't know what the final version will look at, ban the box, so that on job applications you won't be able to ask the question, hopefully getting more people interviews. Will the department, I don't know even know if you're allowed, will you be testifying in support of that bill, or somebody from
co-chairs and Representative Barker, I do not know the answer to that. I don't know if we've given been given approval to support that. I do know that around the Governor's Reentry Council table, this has been a conversation that's been ongoing for quite some time. So we'll get the answer to your question here shortly.
You don't even need to get the answer to me. Just if that's on your radar, is fine. I don't know what the final bill is going to look like. So,
okay. Thank you,
Representative Krieger, and then we've got two more people to present.
Is there any? I was out of the room for a while. Was there any incentives given to employers to provide employment for people that are qualified in some fields?
Co-chairs and Representative Krieger, there is. There's a federal tax waiver for individuals that take on individuals with a record. I will tell you that we've made great advancements just this last year around the collection of those four employers, and I don't have those data points memorized, but we will get them to you because there's been some dramatic growth, and I will attribute that to the collaborations that are happening around the Governor's Reentry Council table. Thank you.
All right, great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Who's next?
Co-chairs, I now have the privilege to introduce to you the first new deputy director of the Oregon Department of Corrections in 11 years. And I know that Ms. Brokamp is not new to many of you, but just briefly for the record, she comes to the table with an enormous amount of experience. She's been with the agency for 23 years. She's a 23-year DOC veteran. She's worked in so many areas in this agency, from fiscal services to facility services. She actually operated and staffed the contentious prison siting, if you all remember that, years ago.
I had
a little PTSD, I see, for some of those members. Managed the Office of Information and Sentencing Calculation, which is one of the most complex parts of our organization. She managed the operations budget, which, as you know, is $800 million of our $1.6 billion. She's been the assistant director of HR. the superintendent of Coffee Creek, the assistant director of the Offender Management and Rehabilitation Division. So I am so proud to have her at my side as the new deputy director, and clearly she comes to the table with an enormous wealth of experience. So with that, I will turn it over to you, Ms. Brokamp.
Thank you, Director. Co-Chair Shields, Co-Chair Williamson, members of the committee. As you heard, I'm Kim Brokamp. I'm the new Deputy Director at the Oregon Department of Corrections, and I'm here today to do brief presentations on two of our backbone divisions, General Services and Human Resources. The General Services Division is really one of the backbones of this agency. It provides services that are fundamental to our day-to-day operations. The four key areas of General Services include fiscal services, information technology, distribution services, and facility services and sustainability. These services are provided directly to employees, offenders, volunteers, community corrections, and other partner agencies. I would also like to point out the General Services Division is also the lead on our Business Continuity Planning Breakthrough Initiative. During an emergency, critical business functions must continue, and this division will take the lead in that function. Next slide. This slide really shows you the percentage of the General Services Division as far as budget. The overall budget for this division is $65 million, with 57 of it being general fund, 8 million of it being other fund, which is revenue generated through our commissary.
And Senator Bates apologized. He has to go to a 2 o'clock meeting.
Thank you. The next slide is FTE by division, and the General Services FTE is 266. The majority of those positions are supply specialists, accountants, procurement and contract specialists, IT professionals, and truck drivers, believe it or not. Most of our staff in the General Services Division are in Salem, but we do have staff throughout the institutions who support those business functions as well. The major budget drivers for the General Services Divisions, as you guys have heard in multiple testimonies, the buildings and the deferred maintenance issues. We have $1.3 billion inventory of old, some old, some new buildings, which we must maintain. Given the scope of our operations, this is a big challenge. And as you've heard, we have a deferred maintenance list of about $68 million. We also have an increased dependence on automation with a very old backbone IT system. As we try to be more efficient and do things more effectively, sometimes the automation issues are harder to catch up on. So that's definitely a budget driver for us when we try to become more efficient and effective in what we do. And then just one other quick note on budget drivers, unpredictable utility and transportation fuel costs. We've had actually mild winter and fuel costs have been down, but that unpredictability erodes S&S budgets in times when it is higher. So now I'd like to dive into the different units. The first unit in the General Services Division is Fiscal Services. They're responsible for the financial tracking and reporting activities of the agency. The unit supports and ensures accuracy, accountability, and efficiency. Specific areas of responsibility include procurement contracts, accounting payroll, our inmate trust system, fiscal systems, and business functions. And has been reported, our DOC accounting team has won a Gold Star Certificate Award for financial reporting every year since 2005. Our IT section. Information Technology Services provides support for over 6,000 users at all DOC prisons, our two DOC community corrections offices, and all of the other 34 community corrections offices. This section develops and maintains software, hardware, and databases that support offender management, inmate programming, and key agency business functions. These systems are utilized 24 hours a day by employees and agency partners. And we do have a separate secure inmate network that inmates access the law library and have education services on. And then we have information security program that ensures this very sensitive and detailed information we have at the Department of Correction is kept private, that the integrity and availability of our information assets are protected. Distribution services. Distribution services provides the primary logistical support for our correctional facilities, a little bit different than a lot of other state agencies. We maintain and manage necessary stock and accurate inventory levels at our central distribution center, as well as warehouses in Madras at Deer Ridge, Two Rivers at Umatilla, and Snake River at Ontario.
This inventory includes expendable and non-expendable goods, such as food products and other direct care items for adults in custody, including clothing, hygiene, and general sanitation items. Centralization of goods purchased through CDC in Salem allows for maximizing cost savings on purchases and more standard more standardized applications across the state. In addition, Distribution Services administers the statewide commissary program, which is a self-supporting enterprise. The commissary supports the DOC goal of reducing recidivism by offering incentive items aimed to encourage good behavior in the adult in custody population. It also allows us sometimes to track sales of targeted products. Sometimes we can tell that there's going to be some type of incident within our facilities. I would also like to just point out, too, that the statewide commissaries and warehouses provide job skills to over 200 inmates, adults in custody across the agency, and hopefully are providing them skills and abilities that they can then use when they leave and get jobs when they are outside.
Just a moment, Representative Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Deputy Director, on the commissaries, I know the last governor was greatly concerned about some of the items available there health-wise, and I don't know, I know there's some pushback on all of that, but I'm just wondering, are we progressing towards having more healthy food items available? And I know that a lot of those end up going back to the distributor because nobody's eating them, but if...
Co-chairs and Representative Barker, I'm happy to take that question. This issue did come up with the healthcare work group, and really it was concluded that while there are items on there that are considered not healthy, like a candy bar as an example, it really is incredibly limited compared to what you would get at Safeway as a free person. And so while we limit a lot of choice in prison, we have to remember that when Measure 11 was passed, we took away the ability to provide earn time to the majority of the offenders in our care and custody. And so often things like commissary, our non-cash incentive programs, really are around managing the inmate population and ensuring that it's safe. Mm-hmm. And you well know, given your public safety background, that public safety inside the prison is incredibly important, and there's nothing more that can unite 14,500 individuals than is taking mm-hmm. away food from them. So we are very conscious around that effort. We work a lot around educating the adults in custody around healthy habits, and that seems to be more effective than actually limiting commissary.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, I'll continue on. Facility services. Facility services administers repair and maintenance programs for institutions and other DOC facilities. Services include helping set priorities for the deferred maintenance, management of lease facilities and property holdings, support for communications infrastructure, and ensuring code compliance and maintenance and repair activities. Facility staff are available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week to provide emergency support. Sustainability, this is an effort the Department of Corrections is very proud on all the work we have done. The General Services Division is taking on coordination of the department's sustainability efforts. Just to give you a couple little highlights, we've completed a sustainability plan and presented it to the Oregon Sustainability Board. We've joined the Energy Trust of Oregon's Strategic Energy Management Cohort, which we have done multiple things through that. You've heard we harvested 275,000 pounds of produce from the gardens in our facilities, and with 47,000 pounds of that being donated to Oregon food banks. And we've received some pretty significant awards on our sustainability efforts, with the most recent one being the Governor's 2014 Sustainability Award. So we're very proud of our efforts.
Mr.
And the Center winners.
Because I do need to have Colette brag a bit about the conservation effort that is being done in Salem. And if you have not visited, and I would recommend, Colette, when the weather's a little better, that you take a group, because the work that's being done, and I'll let you talk to them about it and what's being done in areas that I think, not only from a standpoint that the inmates are doing, but some of the learning skills that they're gleaning in the process.
co-chairs and Senator Winters always happy to take a minute to brag, and I really am proud of these efforts. We had a large acreage. We have a large acreage up above OSCI, the correctional institution we have here outside of Salem, and the Oak Savannah was really at risk. We had sagebrush and other non-native plants really choking out the oak, and we had neighbors who were not happy, but who were incredible partners in this process and really helped us manage the conversation. It allowed us to have an inmate work crew work on this over a month's period of time and really restore a beautiful area of Salem back to its original landscape. And so we would be happy to take you out for a tour, because you can actually see just an absolute line where the restoration began and what it would have looked like before. So we're really pleased with the efforts. Senator Winters helped us along in that conversation and with that collaboration with some of our key neighbors, and we thank her for that introduction as well. Thank you.
Just aside, it's the same neighbors had we not had some conversation and worked with when we cited DPSST, because this is all a part of that area. And when we did cite DPSST, then we looked beyond that piece. And I'm just really pleased with the work that Director Peters and those neighbors have been extraordinarily good partners with us in this venture. But it shows what we can do. And I think, and I would just really encourage in the spring that you do take them up, because it's absolutely beautiful.
Agreed. And I think when we were up there, Representative Williamson can remind me, I think we decided not to wait until the end of session, but to go when it was absolutely crazy, because it was such a beautiful, peaceful spot. Thank you.
Okay. Improving programs and cost savings. The Department of Corrections is always trying for increased efficiency in the operation of state government. Our General Services Division is actively working with other public safety agencies to find efficiencies in payroll and information technology. A target potentially is a shared public safety payroll unit. So we'll be working on this during the coming biennium. Some other efficiencies and cost savings we've had, spots cart rebate information. So DOC has been utilizing procurement cards to make expedient payments to vendors to accrue rebates given to the state for using them. So it, as my slide says, since April 2010, we've received $500,000 in rebates back. So that's pretty significant. I mentioned our central distribution center with all of our space. We work collectively with OCE, DHS, medical countermeasure supplies, and Oregon State Police to provide warehouse storage space. And I didn't know what medical countermeasure supplies were, but it's actually the Oregon Emergency Management supply of masks and hand sanitizer and all the things we would need in a natural disaster or emergency. And then sustainability efforts, kind of as a cost saving, we've developed a fully operational recycle and reuse center at the CDC, and another invitation for anyone who would ever like to come and see that, I'd be more than happy to facilitate that visit. It's an amazing, amazing thing that teaches inmates all about recycling, and we do it in all of our facilities across the state. And one last little point in shared, kind of a shared services and cost savings, we're working collectively with the parole board right now in reworking their PBMIS system, which we share information back and forth. So that concludes my general services presentation. Is there any questions?
Okay. We're good.
Now I will go on to human resources. So the next division I'm going to walk you through is human resources. This division develops and implements a comprehensive full-service human resources program to enable the department to effectively recruit, develop, and retain a highly qualified and rapidly growing workforce. As you know, we have approximately 4,500 employees. We manage 2,400 volunteers, and we have many, many contractors who work for us across the state. And this division is very important for us, as some startling statistics are coming to light for the Department of Corrections. 34.8% of our current workforce is actually eligible to retire right now. And within the next coming 5 years, 53% of our current workforce will be eligible to retire. And if you think of institutional knowledge and folks that you know, walk the floor every day and do that, that's a lot of people who potentially could walk out the door. So the Human Resources Department is actively looking at how they're going to develop a succession planning program that's formalized, organized, offered to any employee, targeting specific positions that we have a high need for, and supported by our executive managers in this agency. In the meantime, I'd like to just go through each of those quick units. Professional development, which includes our staff training section, employee relations, labor relations, and our human resource operations office. But quickly, as a percentage of our budget, the human resources division equals 1% of our total overall budget at $14.6 million. Our FTE, we'll look at that. One of the smallest divisions, just 62.5 FTE. HR provides services that, again, support a team of more than 4,500 staff. One of the largest agencies behind a couple other. And just a reminder, too, I think one thing that differentiates corrections, that you guys know this, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So there's some people who never even see who their HR person is. So we manage those things. And we also manage some things that happen with 14,500 adults in custody that sometimes complicate
things. A couple of questions, Mr. Chair. And you can get back. Your staffing turnover rate. I know in past we've talked about the high percentage of overtime and whether that still exists, and if you can get those figures back to us. And then, because I know that wellness and some of those issues are always there, if you would bring us back, because I know you're trying some initiative to actually talk about improving health and wellness for the staff, and since it's such a highly stressed environment, and so if you bring some of those kinds of things back to us, because I think we all want to make certain that our staff are being well taken care of too, and we understand you're 24/7. We appreciate the work that they're doing and the environment that they have to work in. So I.
Co-Chair, Senator Winters, thank you. We'll be happy to provide that information to you.
Representative, wasn't it? Mr. Chair, also, could the director provide us the vacant positions vacant for 6 months or longer and positions vacant for 12 months or longer? Didn't see that in the briefing.
Co-Chairs and Representative Wisnant, absolutely.
Thank
we'll
you.
We'll get those to you.
Good question. All right. Let's race to the finish line.
Okay. Major budget drivers for the Human Resources Division. In Human Resources, there's always a cost of doing business, arbitrations, torts, bullies, those things. Those cost budget. And then, Senator Winters just mentioned, our safety and wellness initiative. As you heard this week, safety and staff wellness is one of our top priorities. Last biennium, we lost our 9 safety managers and our safety administrator through some cuts. And so through existing resources in HR, we are able to provide 2 HR generalists who work on the early return to work and employee care management program. Definitely not a replacement for 9 safety managers and a safety administrator, but definitely someone to kind of keep it moving while we come up with a better solution. So professional development unit, this is responsible for the coordination of all staff training statewide. This includes our basic corrections course for new corrections officers, new employee orientation for all employees, annual in-service training, and all other courses delivered in the classroom and online. We are also, again, looking at, as I mentioned to you, with those retirement rates, we're looking at succession planning, leadership training, management training. How do we keep our workforce vibrant and moving? This next slide is some pictures from one of our basic corrections course graduations. Just a couple little statistics. In 2014, we held 13 basic corrections courses across the state. 212 students were enrolled in those 13 courses. 27 students of those 212 have resigned or are no longer in the program. 185 have completed the 248.5 hours of the BCC course, and after a certain amount of training and time, they become certified. To date, based on the time length, 27 students have received their corrections certification through DPSST. Those were most likely staff who started training last January or February.
How many of those that come in through Mr. Chair, in through where they've already had prior training or something from, you know, we see advertised through our colleges or other private colleges of training for security guards and guards.
Co-chairs and Senator Winters, we can look at the actual data on that. Anecdotally, when I attend these graduations, it's usually about half. It seems like half come from the private sector, often retail, which is great because this is a customer service job, and the other half might have previous correctional officer, law enforcement, or military experience. I would also put in a plug. These are powerful graduations. If anyone ever wants to attend one, please let me know.
Our employee relations section, it kind of says it all. Application of our labor contracts, advice, guidance, and training to administrators and staff across the state. Their job is to make sure that our policies are up to date and that our managers know how to manage people, and they walk through that. They also conduct personnel investigations, and with a workforce as statewide 24/7 as we have, it's very, very important to have a trained and capable employee relations section. Our labor relations section, our agency works very collaboratively with our two labor unions. Very, very collaboratively. But with those two labor unions, we actually have five collective bargaining agreements. We have our AFSCME security contract. We have our AFSCME Security Plus, which is nurses, food service workers, clerical folks. We have our AFSCME parole and probation in Linn and Douglas counties. We have our AFSCME dentist contract, and we also have a contract with the Association of Corrections Employees, and they're in multiple facilities across our state. I can't say enough how much we enjoy trying to problem solve with those guys before we end up in a more formal type of situation. So it's developed into a very collaborative relationship and problem solving effort together. Human resource operations, this is really kind of everything else in HR. So recruitments and backgrounds, just to give you kind of an idea of the scope of what we go through at Corrections. In 2014, our recruitment section received over 11,000 applications for employment. About 2,100 of those were for correctional officers. The rest were for other positions throughout the department. We do backgrounds right now, pretty complex backgrounds on folks that are coming into correctional officer positions or correctional security positions. We hope to expand that a little further and use our resources to maybe do on some nurses and other positions. We do face recruitment challenges outside the Willamette Valley, specifically around mental health and health services. We really struggle to find doctors in the east side of the state. We also have classification and compensation in this unit. It's made up of one, right? They make sure that positions are classified, and they're working closely with DAS on the Oregon Management Project right now. We administer FEMLA and OFLA through this office. And as we mentioned with some of our staff wellness issues, this office can be very busy at times. And then we also maintain the personnel records of more than 4,500 of all of our employees. Improving programs and cost savings, just a couple things to point out. As we mentioned, you guys all know BCC, our basic corrections course, we used to go through DPSST. In 2014, the legislature continued the department's responsibility for us to provide our own basic corrections course, and that's extended through 2026. We work very closely with DPSST, too, to make sure we're meeting their certification requirements. And then we also, we reported that, I don't know if all of you know this, we use NOOCs in our BCC training. So we have all of our training curriculum loaded on NOOCs so that our staff can enter into the 21st century, and we don't have to kill a lot of trees in providing all that training material, as if you remember the numbers of people who started with us. And then I mentioned the background process. We're going to try to streamline that and do more backgrounds on more candidates we really want to hire. And with that, I'm going to show you that there's an appendix page if anyone wants more information, and I'm available to answer any questions on our Human Resources Division if you have any.
You good? Thank you very much, Kim.
Sure. Co-chairs and members of the committee, that concludes the Department of Corrections formal presentation, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have before I turn it over to Mr. Art Ayer from DAS, who is our BAM analyst.
All right. All right, take it away. Take us home.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee. My name is Art Ayer, and I'm from the Chief Financial Office and Department of Administrative Services. And I will find my presentation here. I'm here to give you a brief overview of the governor's budget for the Department of Corrections. And as the director has mentioned, actually a couple of the top issues that the agency is facing, but not certainly all of them, are a lot of use of temporary emergency beds, nearly all possible use of that, very high use of overtime and staff wellness issues. I won't belabor the 10-year plan. Obviously, the agency is addressing that issue. In the development of the governor's budget, there were a number of issues that were discussed. Obviously, the projected inmate population and the community corrections population. The cost per day for the community corrections population was discussed at some length. The health care issues surrounding the inmate population. The cost and benefit of the electronic health records and deferred maintenance issues, which are ongoing. The need to replace the telephone system. The need to replace the inmate education system, which also provides legal information for the inmates. And then, of course, certainly not least, staff wellness and staffing levels. The budget, this is a graph that shows the prior biennium, the current biennium, and the governor's budget for the coming biennium. General fund, of course, is the major piece in the green on the bottom. There are other small pieces that I've tried to identify by color separately, but obviously general fund is the major piece. In the interest of time, I won't belabor the changes, but if you want more information on this, I'd be happy to provide that. The investments that the governor's budget makes include the electronic health record system, $3 million of general fund, the CIS Corrections Information System replacement project, that's the beginning of that replacement, the Voice Over Internet Protocol telephone system funded with bond funds, and deferred maintenance projects addressing those, as well as the replacement of the inmate educational system. So those are the major investments that the governor's budget makes. There are two budget adjustments, two cuts that the governor's budget makes. One is an increase in the vacancy savings by $10 million and a community corrections reduction of $15 million, which was discussed at some length earlier today and does pose the potential for opt-outs by the county, by the counties. Risks in the budget, obviously the population, the inmate population, the growth of that population is a forecast, but actuals could deviate from the forecast. Healthcare costs could change, but appear to be at this point under control. And the current biennium's budget included a $30 million addition in the rebalance bill that was just passed. But the 15-17 budget was built on the current biennium's budget, so it doesn't carry that $30 million forward into the next biennium. So there's the potential for shortfall in the governor's budget for 15-17. Comparing the governor's budget to the co-chair's framework, both of them include the full, I'm sorry, they include the full prison caseload funding and health services inflation, electronic health record startup, but the co-chair's budget also includes full community corrections mandated caseload funding, whereas the governor's budget cuts that by $15 million, as discussed earlier. The framework does not include investments in the data system, the corrections information system, the telephone conversion, and the deferred maintenance. So that concludes my remarks. I'd be happy to take questions.
4 minutes.
All right. Oh, I've got four more minutes?
No, you only took 4 minutes.
Yes.
Actually, you do.
Well, don't be like a politician where you feel like you have to expand to the available time.
Speak you, for yourself.
did you want to expand?
No.
All right. Tomorrow we have public testimony on the DOC budget. So we will see you staff, or at least some staff will be here.
I will be here.
Great. Thank you.
And I would also like to add that during phase two, the department will come back and talk in more depth about what is included in the governor's budget and other information on packages. And I have them scheduled for one day, but if they need more, we'll give them more.
All right. Great. This meeting is adjourned.
Thank you, everyone.
This meeting is adjourned.
Thank you, everyone.